Let's get this thing rolling, guys. We've got Rick Collins here. Is your website steroidlaw.com?
It is. So that's one of the websites.
Okay.
Yeah, you can go to rickcollins.com and you'll see all of my stuff holistically there. But steroidlaw.com is certainly where people will find a lot of information about performance drugs. I also have a website, Supplement Council, C-O-U-N-S-E-L.com, which is more like the vitamins and the sports nutrition component of things, because I do a lot of work in that area.
Okay.
But yeah, Rick Collins, .com is kind of where you can find links to everything.
All right. So guys, today we are going to talk about all things legal regarding steroids, regarding supplements. I'm especially excited to hear your thoughts about SARMs and research chems and that kind of stuff. We've got a bunch of stuff though that we're going to get into here. Man, I'll tell you, Rick, everybody has so many questions about the legalities of just where everything stands. I mean, this
right.
is kind of a, it's kind of a wild west still as far as bodybuilding itself, man. There's a lot of really good people in the sport. And then there's a lot of really dark sides to the sport too. And I'm excited to explore that stuff, with you today. Now, what do you do as far as like law goes? Like what kind of law stuff are you involved with? What kind of situations do you work?
So my background is originally as a prosecutor. So I was the guy who was helping to put people in jail for, doing bad things typically. So I did that for 5 years when I finished law school. And then I went to private practice.
Okay.
And that was in 1990. And so me and two other lawyers who were also former DAs hung out at Eagles, and we did bread and butter criminal defense for a couple of years. And, there's a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers that talks about, what's the key to success? Is it hard work? Is it who you know? Is it timing? Is it who your parents were? And timing is a huge factor.
Okay.
And the year that I went into private practice, 1990, happened to be the year that Congress criminalized anabolic steroids.
Okay, yeah.
Up until then, if you remember, up until then, there were sort of like super vitamins. It was kind of like a niche kind of thing. There were some bodybuilders who used it, but there were more and more athletes, competitive athletes, who were using it. And in 1988, at the Seoul Olympics, Ben Johnson, who was a Canadian sprinter, ran really, really fast.
Yes, he
set
did.
A record. and beat the American, Carl Lewis.
Yeah.
So you have this Canadian who beats the American and then tests positive for steroids. And Congress went ballistic, and lots of hearings were held in in the aftermath of the Ben Johnson doping scandal in 88 and 89. And in 90, they criminalized anabolic steroids by essentially taking a performance drug that was used by people not so much for any, to some degree for performance, but mostly for cosmetics. But certainly not for any kind of high or depressant or stimulatory
sure.
or hallucinogenic effect, and put it into the same law that had heroin and cocaine and marijuana and typical narcotics and drugs of abuse. And so that changed in 1990. And so in the years that followed that, there was a lot of disconnect between the community of people who were using steroids, typically the bodybuilders, the hardcore bodybuilders, some athletes, and the law enforcement agents, and the cops, and the lawyers, and the prosecutors, and the judges, and the medical authorities, who were all trying to figure out, well, now we have a new controlled substance. How do we deal with this?
Yeah.
And my background in bodybuilding and the gym world, combined with my kind of unique skill set of being able to be a trial lawyer who knew the criminal justice system, could try a case as a prosecutor, and yet was working now as a defense lawyer, my phone started ringing in those years. And so I began to represent bodybuilders who were getting jammed up on steroid beefs,
okay.
which a few years earlier wouldn't have been a controlled substance, wouldn't have been a federal case at all. And now suddenly people are being arrested. Huh. And so I kind of saw that there was this information gap where the guys in the gyms didn't understand how the law had changed and what the risks were. And the people in the courthouse were not understanding these drugs or why people would be using them or whether they get you high or does it cause, you know, roid rage and all those things.
Yeah.
And so I created that website that you referenced, steroidlaw.com, to sort of bridge that gap. Huh. And provide information to those two worlds, because in a sense, I've got a foot in each of those worlds.
Yeah.
I've got a foot in the gym world and always have. I've got a foot in the legal community. That's what I do for a living. And so in the years that followed, my practice ultimately began to be exclusively in the area of where bodybuilding, fitness, vitamins, sports nutrition intersect with legal issues, whether it's criminal legal issues or in doping cases, administrative issues. Mm. So whether you're arrested for steroid possession or sale or importation, or whether you're accused of doping in a sport, or whether you're accused of steroid use in a drug-tested occupation, like, for example, as a police officer, and I've represented police officers accused of using steroids based on a urine test. And that kind of expanded because I love what I do. I love the bodybuilding community. I love fitness. I love nutrition. And so it expanded, and ultimately I started representing companies in the legal performance space.
Okay.
So sports nutrition products. Oh. I've represented lots of companies that have sports nutrition brands, whether it's selling protein or supplements of all kinds, to consumers. Mm. And so my firm does, you know, with me sort of spearheading it, kind of if you're in the fitness space with any kind of substances, legal, illegal, nutritional, that's kind of where my space is. My law firm does other things.
Sure.
My partners do bread and butter criminal defense. I have a partner who does personal injury work. So it's a multi-purpose firm. So we have many divisions that do different things. But my division, what I do, is unique. I don't think there's really any other lawyer that typically does it.
No, you're the guy. You're the guy.
Which is nice.
And through this, Rick, you kind of become like a celebrity within our sport. As like the steroid lawyer, you're the guy who's gone to bat for people. And talking to you too, I think one thing I'd like to ask you right here is let's talk about, so there's the legal side of steroids, but then while we spoke on the phone the other week, you really got me thinking, because I mean, one of the things you brought up was, you know, it's our right to be able to do what we want with our bodies. And that, you know, if you're
in some respects, yes,
and that it should be, and that maybe our rights are being infringed upon a little bit, and that there's a lot of confusion, I think, not only with us understanding the laws, but I think, as you mentioned, there was a lot of confusion of the law and why it's really even in place to begin with. Can you talk a little bit more about this whole gray area about where we stand and what are your thoughts about the legality of steroids?
So, you know, I often say that steroids are the only drug that was criminalized, not because of what it does bad for you so much as what it does good for you.
Okay.
Which is kind of a weird thing. And what it does good for you is it makes you run faster, makes you jump further, makes you bigger, stronger, faster, which in a sport that is all about fairness and integrity and this concept that sports are supposed to be about hard work and genetic gifts and not about chemistry, steroids are sort of the dirty part of sports.
Yeah.
And so it was in the aftermath of the Ben Johnson scandal that Congress said, we're going to criminalize steroids, not because so much, not because of the focus on that they get you high or that there's, you know, deaths occurring like in the opiate crisis or anything like that, but because athletes are using it and athletes are using it to cheat. And the fair level playing field that Congress perceived, which we can debate whether really exists, but the level playing field that they believed existed was being upset by that. And of course, Congress was upset about younger kids, high school athletes who might look at these, you know, sports stars. And if they hear that they're on steroids, well, then that might make the kids want to use steroids. So a lot of it was saving the children kind of concepts.
Yeah.
And so Congress took the step of adding steroids into the Controlled Substances Act to make it easier to police steroids in sports and cheating in sports. Which, you know, look, I think if you sign on to agree to not use something in a sport and then you use it, that's cheating, arguably, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you've signed on, if you agree not to wear white socks and you wear them, right. you're violating a rule.
Sure.
Certainly.
Sure.
And even I think if 9 out of 10 athletes in a sport are also using steroids, there's probably that one athlete who isn't, and that's unfair to that one athlete, certainly.
Yeah.
So there's certainly an argument why steroids, you know, should be, as long as they're against the rules, that it's a bad thing in sports. Whether they should be against the rules is a different debate, but
sure.
Certainly as it stands now, that's the case. But the question becomes, what about people who aren't competing in sports?
Yeah.
What if you're not a competitive athlete? What if you're not even using steroids for a performance advantage over somebody else? What if you just want to take training to a different level and you want to get bigger and you want to get leaner and you want to get jacked, what should the rules on that be? As it stands now in federal law and in the law of almost every state, the possession of an anabolic steroid outside a legitimate prescription for a medical purpose, and you know, bigger biceps and a bigger bench is not a medical purpose anyway. So for a non-medical purpose, the possession of any amount of an anabolic steroid is a crime.
Yeah.
So and in some states it's a misdemeanor. Under federal law it's a misdemeanor. But in some states, it's a felony.
Mm.
Even one tablet of Anadrol, one amp of Sustanon, that would be a felony in certain states. And volume, for the purposes of distribution, possession with intent to give to other people, to sell to other people, that's a felony in virtually every state and under federal law. So there's this risk there.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of people know that now, but that wasn't the case in the 80s, but it's certainly the case now. And I've seen people arrested and represented, more people than I can ever count, on steroid-related crimes, whether it's for distribution, trafficking, importation, or in some cases just simple possession. And I've represented people who have had a car stop, the car gets searched and they've got a gym bag in the car and they've got some gear in the gym bag. I've represented people in many cases where they have some sort of altercation with a spouse, a girlfriend, wife, whatever, and she dials the phone and puts in a call to the police, and there's steroids in the house. So I've seen all sorts of things like that, there's always a risk. Today, I see most of the people that I represent on steroid charges, most of them now are underground lab guys.
Okay, and that seems like it's getting more popular. I'd love to ask you more about that. Can I ask you one thing, though, before
sure.
I do? Something I've seen change a lot, and I'm sure you've noticed this too. So maybe 10 years ago, just the climate, the culture in general was much more hush hush. You wouldn't see guys that were going on Instagram and saying, oh yeah, I'm taking 3 cc's of this and 5 cc's of that.
Right.
Now it's a completely different ball game. What people are doing now, we would have been shocked 10 years ago. Right. It would almost lead me to believe that there's kind of a relaxing of the laws. Is that the case?
Well, first, I think the things that we do on social media now, in all respects, are things that we could not have imagined, right?
Good point.
I mean, social media has changed our concepts of privacy, of what's acceptable to expose about ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, just go on, you know, 90% of Instagram, you know, you'll see that people are now much more open about what they share.
Yeah.
Many share too much in every respect. But and so naturally, I think that would go with the things that we're using to get bigger or stronger or look better or have abs for summer or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So so I think that's probably the phenomenon. I am seeing probably less people arrested these days for mere possession than I used to.
Okay.
And the standard to arrest somebody is basically probable cause. They have to have the police or agents would have to have a reasonable belief that a crime was being committed and that it was, you know, close in time. So getting on a website and saying, you know, here's what I've used in the past probably wouldn't be a basis for getting a search warrant or anything like that.
Okay.
Maybe if you said, I've got 5 kilos of testosterone cypionate, you know, just delivered to me and it's in my, on my kitchen table right now.
Yeah.
And here's a picture of it. Probably, you know, if there was an agent watching that, might be able to quickly go to a judge and say, hey, I've got this case.
Yeah.
But short of that, we don't, I don't see that happening all that often.
Okay.
I used to see, and this is an interesting thing, Scott, because, you know, steroids were criminalized and the idea was to sort of, you know, protect the public from steroids in addition to policing sports. And at the time that that happened back in the 90s, most of the product on the market was FDA diverted prescription drug products.
Okay, yeah.
So you had, you know, drug companies that maybe knew that the volume they were pumping out was more than what was really medically necessary. And so back in those days, guys would go to a friendly pharmacist or whatever and, you know, a little brown bag filled with, you know, 10 cc vials of testosterone, you know, FDA approved legitimate product would go in the bag and it would be a cash transaction. There were no cameras in those days. It was a different world.
Yeah.
When Congress criminalized steroids in 1990 and the law went into effect in 91, the big pharmaceutical companies, they're all about money. Let the big pharma is a like any, you know, industry is profit driven. And so when there was less demand for testosterone and steroids in the aftermath of the criminalization, the big pharmaceutical companies started to bring down the volume of what they were doing. And so when, you know, basic economic principle kicks in, when you've got demand and you've got a diminished supply, suddenly, you know, legitimate pharmaceutical steroids were drying up. And so opportunity came knocking for alternative sources to meet the demand. And so for a while, we were seeing Mexican products, which were like appearing. And so a lot of the products were coming from south of the border, being muled up or coming into the U.S. and in order to kind of skate through customs and get into the country easier, there was less scrutiny of veterinary drugs than human drugs. And so you started having all of these products with pictures of horses and, you know, farm animals. And so, yes, but the volume that was coming would jack up every horse, cow, dog, cat, mouse, you know, in America. So government, you know, got wise to that and started to crack down on that. And then you started seeing other countries, you know, Eastern Europe, others beginning to meet the demand. And then as the, you know, particularly in post 9/11, when suddenly the scrutiny of the mail exponentially increased, and we had a much higher level of interdiction from a mail standpoint, suddenly it became harder and harder to get finished product into the United States. So what happens then? Well, you know, if there's a demand, there's going to be a supply. And so what we now have from a you know, raw material source is the importation of raw powders, typically, in volume from Asia or India, typically mislabeled as taurine or some amino acid or something like that, brought into the United States at the order of a chemist, an amateur chemist, underground lab guy, who then esterifies it, makes it. Maybe he's got a pill press, you know, for orals. Maybe he's got, you know, the glassware for injectables. And that's the product we have. So the products that are out on the market typically now are products that were made in somebody's house, maybe their kitchen or their basement or somewhere in their house. And quality control, of course, is determined by, you know, the meticulousness of the guy who's making it.
Right.
So, and I've had clients, I got to tell you, I have clients who are very, very, you know, careful about quality control.
Okay.
I mean, they're super, so their products will, you know, arguably rival you know, legitimate products, to the extent that anything you buy over the internet, you know, you'd want to rely on.
Yeah.
But I've also had some clients who are not so good, and who are not very careful on dosing, on potential contamination issues. So, you know, you hear of some guys who are getting abscesses and things like that, or, you know, products that are substandard, you know, and sort of, if you compare the safety and quality overall of the products back before the government started cracking down was much better than it is now. Arguably, it was FDA approved product.
Yeah.
And the sources for then, which were, in addition to what I said before, like the you know, friendly pharmacists, so to speak, there were also a lot of friendly doctors who would be very open to it. And that kind of cracked down when they became controlled substances, at least for a long time.
Sure.
So, so you really made it more dangerous by, you know, trying to crack down on it, which, you know, raises some issues. And so, you know, we were talking, I guess, about the idea of, you know, freedom and, you know, whether these people should be able to use these substances, putting aside the risks and the legal risks that we've talked about, and, you know, arguably the health risks, because if you're buying something over the internet from some guy who's, you know, selling gear on Reddit or Instagram, you're really relying on, you know, you're injecting that into your body.
Yeah.
But I guess the question becomes, you know, should that be your own autonomy? You know, should you be able to make that decision? You know, certainly from a libertarian standpoint, that I think there's a strong argument for it. As long as you're not hurting somebody else, why shouldn't you have the right to do what you want with your body? I mean, we allow people to take all sorts of crazy risks with their bodies.
Sure.
You know, you could eat at McDonald's and or you know, fast food, you know, all day long until you're a type 2 diabetic, and then, you know, the government will have to, if you don't have the money, taxpayers will treat you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you'll get the care. So, you know, is that fair? You're allowed to drink alcohol to whatever excess you want.
Yeah.
You're allowed to smoke cigarettes, even though we know of the cancer links, you know. You're allowed to do things like skydive. I'm a licensed skydiver.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and I kind of did that in part to overcome my fear of heights.
Did it work?
And it did, actually.
Okay.
You know, once you've thrown yourself out of a plane at 13,000 feet, you know, you're not so scared on, you know, when you're on the ladder on top of your house. But I also did it to almost like prove the point that, you know, government allows me to do this, right? You know, I can throw myself out of a plane,
yeah.
But yet the government will intercede. And if I went to a black market source of steroids, you know, he'd get arrested, I'd get arrested. If I went to a doctor and said to the doctor, there's nothing wrong with me, I just want to be jacked.
Yeah.
And the doctor gave me steroids, sold me steroids, prescribed me steroids, he'd get locked up.
Yeah.
So is there a double standard, you know, particularly when this is typically for most people a cosmetic drug,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, some guys will say, well, cosmetic, it sounds kind of, you know, foo-foo.
Yeah,
you know?
But at the end of the day, you're not looking to enhance your performance. Most people I know that have used steroids have been because they wanted to look a certain way. That's cosmetic. So,
right. I mean, you could call it aesthetic instead of cosmetic,
sure,
but
sure.
It's semantics.
Sure.
As a practical matter, you know, it's guys who want bigger arms, bigger chest, tighter waist, you know, better abs, you know, yeah, it's nice if the bench goes up too. Right. So, but those sorts of, you know, body concerns of improving the way you look, even though there's potential risks involved, which there are with any drug, and, you know, certainly steroids are not risk-free, you know, even as prescribed, any drug has side effects, but so do all the cosmetic procedures that we do allow, right? So, you know, you can get Botox, you can get liposuction. People
sure.
died on the liposuction table.
Huh.
You know, there was a story you may have heard a few years ago, some kid went to Mexico for calf implants
because
it was cheaper to get them down there, and it got infected, and basically he had a double amputation. Ooh. Both legs amputated purely for vanity, for calf implants. And the reality is, you know, if steroids would have helped his calves, you know, that certainly would have been the better option for him, the lesser of the evils, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the question becomes, you know, why do we really demonize this, but yet you can go and, you know, a woman who's an aspiring, you know, adult movie star or, you know, strip clubber,
yeah.
Would be able to go and ask for breast implants of a size that probably isn't healthy and
sure.
take all sorts of risks of infection and, you know, general anesthesia, purely for vanity and probably against better judgment in some cases, certainly. But yet we value that person's autonomy.
Yeah.
It's her body. So why, you know, if that's what she wants and that's how she wants to look, then she should have the right to do that. And if somebody wants to get liposuction, okay, maybe it's vanity. Maybe maybe it's not a good choice. Maybe you don't need it even. But should you be allowed to do that? And so the question becomes whether steroids are sort of singled out.
Mm.
Yeah, as a cosmetic procedure, as because it's sort of the male counterpart to breast implants, maybe or something, that because of the performance issue, because of the athletic cheating issue, to me is what separates it. It's that nobody's going to run faster because they got, you know, huge breast implants.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So and so I think, you know, when we look back and we realize that the Ben Johnson scandal is where the criminalization of steroids came from, I think that tells us why steroids are criminalized, all these other things are not, and why we don't have the libertarian attitude about steroids, why it's a paternalistic, you know, you're not allowed to do it. And in fact, if you do it, you risk legal repercussions, which in some cases can be worse than the bad effects of what steroids might be. You know, I've seen people who get, look, you know, you go to jail, you get a felony conviction. I mean, your life is turned upside down. You know, bad things happen. You know, try getting a job, try getting a license when you're a convicted felon.
Yeah.
You know, try coming back from a prison term.
Mm.
So I've been an advocate, not so much for, you know, steroids, well, not at all for the drug itself, although I think that, you know, the risks, even the medical risks, have been wildly overplayed by the media, but for the idea that we should at least look at laws, and that the laws should make sense, that they should be fair, that we shouldn't treat things that might be treated the same differently.
Yeah.
And that we should generally respect personal autonomy and bodily autonomy with people, unless what they're doing is just so bad that we want to disallow it. And when we compare maybe steroids and tobacco, or even steroids and alcohol, I'm not sure the current laws really are justified on that level.
That's kind of the vibe I got from you. That's kind of why I wanted to ask, because I feel like I just get the vibe that you've kind of sensed an imbalance. And so some of the people that you've worked with, you've maybe wanted to defend people who might not be getting treated fairly. And I knew I wasn't going to get just a direct straight answer from you. So I love the way that you kind of danced around to get to that.
Well, I'm a lawyer, right? So, I think to follow up on that answer, I'll say this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a criminal defense lawyer on many cases. And yet in many, many years, almost no cases have I ever represented somebody who has stolen money from somebody, who's physically harmed somebody, who's robbed somebody. Almost all of my clients are people who are involved in the bodybuilding or sports industry or the fitness industry. And so I love what I do.
Yeah.
I'm passionate about it. I think that clients appreciate my representation because they see me as a kindred spirit,
yes,
as a non-judgmental person. There are so many lawyers out there who wouldn't know an Anadrol from an aspirin.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have no clue and they are judgmental and, you know, what do you got to use that stuff for all the, you know, they think it's a, you know, an intravenous injection like heroin. And so I'm very blessed to be able to represent people that typically are the same kind of guys that have been training partners of mine for many years, or the guys that I know in the gym who are basically decent people and who are making a choice which the law doesn't allow.
Yeah. Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows.
All right, I'm going to shift topics a little bit because I'm dying to know more about where are we now with SARMs, with peptides, with research chems. You know, we all see these sites everywhere. These things are, from what I understand, you know, a lot of these things are being sold within the U.S. This is no mystery. Some of these places, I think, are even accepting credit cards. It's like, it's basically like shopping at Amazon. This looks legit. Like, this is a legit company. From obviously I know better. That's not the case. Where are we at with these things? And I guess let's talk just research chem shops in general to start. But then I'd like to get more specific and learn, because I know that SARMs have their own legal stance, I'm sure, and peptides have their own as well.
Right. So a number of years ago, it had to be maybe closing on 20, I guess. Somebody came up with the idea. I don't know or remember who it was, but somebody came up with the idea that if you want to sell active pharmaceutical ingredients or drugs that, you know, were never approved, maybe they never went through the approval process, but we know they might have certain effects on the body, that if we mark them as for research purposes only, okay, and we get the buyer to be part of that, to buy into that, and basically agree, yes, I attest and affirm that I'm not using this. I'm just going to use it for research. That's all. That's not for personal use. That you could sort of circumvent the drug approval process that would otherwise be required to sell something as a drug, and drug being defined as a substance that's intended to affect the structure or function of the body. That's what, other than a food. So putting foods aside, you know, if you sell a glass of, you know, oil, and you say this is to cure your cancer, that claim alone makes it a drug.
Okay.
Okay. So anything that's intended to affect the structure or function of the body is a drug.
Yeah.
And so if you say it's for research, well, then it's not really a drug. It's just a chemical. Huh. And so the idea of research chemicals became the nomenclature, the sort of the name that was used to describe this. And people started putting it on websites as the internet kind of exploded in commerce. People would put it on a website and would sell these chemicals. And typically in the beginning, there were a lot of bodybuilding chemicals. So it might be a peptide of some kind, or it might be the raw ingredient, the active pharmaceutical ingredient in a drug, let's say the ingredient for Arimidex, and Astrazole. So different anti-estrogens, different erectile dysfunction drugs, things like that, that bodybuilders might want to get their hands on outside the scope of a prescription, so they could go online and they could order it for research purposes and then, you know, and get it delivered. And so they're sort of part of this, you know, wink, wink. And the seller knows that it's not really going to a laboratory or into a rat. It's, you know, the dude wants it.
Yeah.
So, so that was the idea, and it expanded, the market grew until suddenly and the government usually takes a long time to figure out, you know, a new phenomenon, longer than it should.
Okay.
And I wrote an article I did an interview with a guy many years ago, about research chemicals and what the legal status would be. And at that point, there really hadn't been anybody arrested. And I said, well, I could see how the government would see this as a fraudulent transaction and a fraudulent business, that you're basically committing a fraud, not on the buyers, because they're part of the fraud, but on the FDA, on the government, because the FDA has a right to be part of a drug approval process. And so when you kind of bypass them, you're basically, you know, circumventing FDA's right under the law to approve drugs, to know what's going on.
Yeah.
So you've sort of you've bypassed and defrauded FDA. And when you say it's for research chemicals under circumstances that you know it's not for research, well, that's a fraud on FDA. That's misleading FDA to try to get them to not think it's a drug transaction.
Yeah,
right. So nothing happened for another couple of years until it did. And I had one of the first cases, if not the first case, and the second case and the third case, where FDA figured it out and started looking at these companies to figure out whether this was legit or not. And of course, the devil's in the details. I guess if you were running a research chemical company selling it not for human use, but you were only shipping to universities and medical centers under, you know, those sorts of conditions, that, you know, then maybe it would be legit. But that was never the case with any of the companies I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, and so the government looks at individual facts like, you know, who ordered it? Oh, it's an email, youngandhugeguns@AOL.com. Okay.
Yeah.
It's being shipped to college dorms and private residences. Okay. Oh, let's look at the emails. Oh, there's actually email interactions with customers where customers ask questions like, you know, oh, I got an abscess. I need more of it. It's not working. You know, all indications that these people are not researchers. And so little by little, the case gets built. And most of these cases have been built around those sorts of individualized facts that make it such that no reasonable person could possibly have thought that the customer base were researchers. That virtually everybody was not a researcher. They were individual users. And then sometimes the government would then pose as a researcher, as a customer, and order and have it delivered, and then ask some questions and engage in some interactions. In one case, a FDA agent posing as a prospective buyer of the company went to visit with the client actually interacted with the client, pretending, oh, so how much are you making? And of course, the defendant in the case was more than happy to extol how well he was doing.
Because he wants to sell the business. Wow.
Right. Of course. The problem was it was all recorded. It was used, as evidence. So those are, that's sort of the law on it. And so the reality is that those people who've done it, and I've represented a lot of them successfully, the government will usually go after them for the introduction of misbranded or unapproved drugs into interstate commerce with the intent to defraud and mislead the FDA.
That doesn't sound good.
That's the idea.
That doesn't sound like a good charge to have against you.
No, it's not a good charge. And they'll typically pile on. The government isn't, they'll pile on charges of mail fraud and money laundering and other charges as well. And they won't always just go after the business. They'll often go after the individual.
Really?
So you're, So there's definitely risks there. There are some unique issues of defense in these cases, which I think I have probably a better handle on than anybody, and has enabled me to keep most of my clients out of jail. And they're legitimate defense issues that deal with the federal sentencing guidelines that a lot of lawyers probably, because I do so much of this, I kind of have a perspective on it that has developed over time. And I've been very successful at minimizing the fallout for people. But I certainly wouldn't recommend it. And just being arrested, no matter what the ultimate, effect of it is, or getting a conviction, even if you don't go to jail, a misdemeanor or a felony conviction, it rides with you in, certainly a federal conviction. We have no expungement law for federal crimes.
Okay.
So once you get convicted of a felony in the United States under a federal charge, it's going to go to the grave with you. And it's going to be on applications for a loan. It's going to be, in all sorts of ways in your life. So, I definitely don't recommend it. I do get a lot of calls from people who say, hey, Rick, I got this great idea. I want to sell chemicals for research purposes. Can you help me set that business up?
Yeah.
And I tell them all the same thing. It's like, that's not what I do. I'm a busy guy. And I do what I think helps people the most. And that is, if you get caught for doing something wrong, if the feds are at the door, if you get a subpoena, that's where I'll get involved. But I don't get involved in counseling people on the front end of how to do this.
Yeah.
Because quite frankly, I don't think anybody who's looking to do that business really is looking to sell chemicals to facilities that do research.
Yeah.
I think they're mostly looking to sell it to individual users. And that's the problem.
That makes sense. So the legality of SARMs, I know that that's something that's changed in recent times. Can you talk a little bit about that? And are they going after people that are selling SARMs specifically?
So SARMs are a category, selective androgen receptor modulators of substances that are not controlled at this time. So unlike steroids or, heroin or Vicodin or cocaine, which are all controlled substances, SARMs are not controlled substances, although there are some bills, some pieces of legislation pending in Congress that would put SARMs into that category.
Okay.
If and when that happens, then we're talking, then it's a different, you know, a different set of laws that would apply to them than that apply at this time. And frankly, I'm not sure that SARMs should be classified as controlled substances, because I don't think they meet the criteria to be a controlled substance. But sometimes Congress cares more about, you know, getting something off the street than the technical requirements or criteria.
Okay.
So, you know, we'll see what happens with that. But as it stands now, SARMs are typically sold in one of two ways on the black market, because they're mostly not approved as drugs. So you can't get them as a pharmaceutical product. One is you'll see some of them sold in the form of dietary supplements. And there have been a number of companies that were selling openly on the internet or in mom and pop health food stores, Ostarine,
sure,
and other SARMs, labeled as a dietary supplement, you know, and sold. And I've gotten calls from people who say, you know, I bought some Ostarine at the health food store, you know. So the problem is SARMs don't fit the definition of a dietary supplement. So anybody buying Ostarine or a SARM as a dietary supplement product, that's not a legal product, because supplements are, you know, vitamins and supplements are a very distinct category. They have to meet certain criteria. SARMs are, you know, created in a lab. These are synthetic compounds. They're not the ingredients in food. They're not found in the food supply in any way.
Yeah.
They're not vitamins or minerals or amino acids. So they can't be sold as supplements. And I have seen, I haven't seen too many state cases in terms of SARMs, but I have seen federal cases involving supplements involving, you know, that had SARMs in them. And the government looks at it as an illegal distribution of a misbranded drug or an unapproved drug in interstate commerce, mislabeled or fraudulently labeled as a dietary supplement. And I've also seen the other way that the SARMs are sold is through the pathway that we talked about before, which is as research chemicals.
Okay.
And so I see a lot of that as well. And again, you know, you're buying something that is really a fraudulent transaction by its nature. You're saying it's for research. It's not for research. He's selling it for research. It's not for research. The only, you know, party that's not part of the wink and the nod is the FDA. Who is being led to believe that it's a transaction that it's not.
So it sounds like right now it's not really a hot topic for the government, but it could be in the future, especially if the laws change.
Well, if right now it's an FDA issue,
okay.
FDA I think is probably under-resourced for a lot of this, the Office of Criminal Investigations. They've gone after some SARMs cases for research SARMs and for dietary supplement SARMs, but there's still a lot out there. And I think there's just more than what FDA can handle. If the law changes and SARMs become a controlled substance, then the FDA steps back and the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, steps in.
Yeah.
And the DEA has more resources and the DEA has more aggressive laws to go after, with, you know, higher potential punishments. And so when that happens, that will be probably a more aggressive tackling of SARMs than are going on now. But still, anyone selling them for research purposes or as supplements, you're taking a big risk.
Okay.
You know, you're taking a risk that you know, FDA gets wind of it for whatever reason. And, you know, cases start for different reasons. A competitor could drop it on, you know, call up and you know, or somebody gets sick and they're, you know, a kid buys something and the mom looks at the bottle and says, oh my God, what is this? This is what he took, and calls the FDA. And suddenly, even if the actual injury had nothing to do with the, you know, with the product, it could start an investigation. So you never know. There's always risk there. And peptides are sort of, you know, fitting into the research chemical box as well. And so there's no, they're not controlled, And there's no bill that would make them a controlled substance. But again, people selling them for research purposes are committing, you know, a fraud on FDA if they know or should know that this, that's not really what it is. Human growth hormone, if we're going to talk about peptides, I guess we should mention, is in a different category than other peptides. And so human growth hormone is under its own law in the United States. It's 21 USC 333E. It has its own little law.
Yeah.
And it's a, someday we can talk maybe in another show how that came to be. Because that, just like the story of how steroids came to be controlled, there's an interesting story about why Congress does certain things. And it's a window, I think, you know, in a broader sense, the story of how steroids became controlled and how growth hormone got its own law is almost a window into how our laws get made.
Hmm.
Almost like watching the sausages get made. It's interesting to see,
yeah,
you know, why Congress, how Congress processes dealing with social or national issues. And it may apply to many of the laws that are made that we deal with every day. And if we really knew how those other laws wound up getting on the books, it may surprise us.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, we're running low on time here, and I asked you for an hour of your time. I'm going to ask you a favor. You could say no if you don't have time.
Uh-oh.
You told a story. This is quite some time ago. You told this to the DA show audience, Derek Anthony, rest in peace, and shout out to anybody who's listening right now that was also a fan of the DA show. I know we've got a few of you guys out there. You told a story on that show that I haven't heard since. And if you have the time, I would love to hear it. This is about, how can I say this without, how can I set you up without giving the punchline away? This was the person who was allegedly selling gear in vitamin bottles.
Yes.
At their gym. Do you got the time?
I do.
All right.
Do.
Awesome. Awesome.
And
this is good, guys.
A little over time. And I'll say this, rest in peace, Derek. Derek was one of the best. I mean, Derek was a client. He was a friend. He was one of the best audiences I could ever have asked for whenever I told a story on his show.
He was so cool.
He was a great guy, and he's one of the ones that we've lost. And, you know, when I think of him, I also think of David Durth, who passed, the wild child, who was also a good friend of mine and also a great audience for all of my nonsensical stories and nonsense. So the story that I told Derek, and he was like hanging on every word, he loved this story, was a few years ago, I got a phone call from a competitive female bodybuilder in a faraway state who called me up to say that she had been accused and was charged with selling a single 10cc vial of testosterone in her personal training gym for $100 and that she wanted to fight the case.
Okay.
And so I said, okay. So I asked her a few questions, and she said, well, they're offering me probation if I plead guilty to a felony, but I'm not pleading guilty to anything. I didn't do it. I'm innocent. Now, she was a high-ranking female bodybuilder, and you know, I'm assuming at some level may have had some experience on a personal level with anabolic steroids,
okay,
but was adamant that she had never and would never sell any steroid to anybody. And the idea that she would do it in her kind of one-on-one personal training gym, which is mostly like business executives, was nuts. So I said, okay. So I call up the prosecutor on the case. And the prosecutor says, I don't know what you're talking about. She is as guilty as the day is long. It is an open and shut case.
Okay.
I'm like, really? What's the story? He's like, well, here's what happens. We've got an undercover informant who is working off his own case. You know, a snitch, a rat, whatever you want to call him.
Yeah.
And he places a phone call, cold call, to her at her gym, in which he says, I want you to train me. I want you to give me a diet. I want to get in shape. And will you sell me some anabolic steroids? She, he tells me, says, yeah, here's what you do. Come in tomorrow to the gym.
Yeah.
And I will give you a training program. I'll give you a diet program. And I'll sell you a vial of steroids. And I'll hide it in a bottle of vitamins. And I'll sell you that for $100.
Now, this is all taped, you're saying?
No. This is not taped. This is a cold call.
Oh, I see. I got you. Okay.
This is a cold call by the informant, who then, after that call, calls up the cop that he's working with and says, hey, I just had a conversation I want to tell you about.
Yeah.
This woman says she's going to sell me a vial of steroids tomorrow if I show up at her gym.
Okay. Okay.
Cop goes, okay, sounds good. Meet me tomorrow morning. He meets the cop. The cop wires him up. Now we're going to record. Cop wires him with a hidden microphone.
Holy shit.
Gives him $100. Okay.
Yeah.
And says, okay, go at it. All right. And so he frisks him to make sure he doesn't have that. The snitch doesn't have anything on him.
Okay.
Other than the $100 that the cop gave him and nothing else. But the cop does let the snitch drive his own car 2 blocks to the gym, okay? Because he doesn't want to, he wants it to look natural, not tip anybody off.
Yeah.
So the guy goes into the gym and has a conversation. And at some point, and it's all recorded, at some point there's some discussion about steroids. And he says, what about steroids? And she says on tape, well, I don't typically endorse steroids. You know, they are part of some levels of bodybuilding and competition, but I don't recommend them to people, you know, who are just starting out.
Yeah.
Okay. Kind of, you know, okay, fair enough. He then says, well, what about that bottle of vitamins that we talked about yesterday? She goes, oh yeah. Okay. Well, I'll get you those. So you hear them walk out to the counter and he gets the vitamins and takes that bottle of vitamins, says goodbye to her, takes that bottle of vitamins out to the cop, gets back in his car, drives to where the cop meets him 2 blocks away, hands a bottle of multivitamins to the cop.
Yeah.
Cop unscrews the lid, opens it up. Guess what's inside? Vial of testosterone, just like he said.
Huh.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow. All right. So cop waits now a week or two, maybe 3 weeks, and then executes a search warrant on her home.
Huh.
Which she shares with her husband, who's a power lifter. They find steroids in the home, in the bedroom.
Okay.
But they're on his side of the bedroom.
Okay.
And they're not the same brand of the steroid that was inside the vial, inside the bottle of vitamins.
Okay. Now, at this point, are you suspicious of anything?
So I said, all right, so you got steroids in the house. You've got this, the initial call, the cold call is not recorded. What do you want to do with this case? He says, listen, I'm willing to give her probation if she pleads to a felony. If she doesn't, we have a 3 strikes and you're out rule.
Hmm.
And she has 3 strikes, even though she's never got a prior legal problem. Strike one was a drug phone call. Regarding that cold call.
Oh.
That's count one. Count, you know, the second strike is the transaction itself. The third strike is steroids in the house.
Holy
Those
shit.
Three things together, she's looking at 10 years.
Holy
so if she
shit.
Wants to fight this case, she's going to prison for 10 years if she loses.
Wow.
Okay. So I call her back and I'm like, listen, this is, you know, this is some serious stuff. Here's what he's saying. And I tell her, she says, well, I'm not pleading guilty. Under no circumstances am I pleading guilty. Yes, there were steroids in the house. They were not mine. Yes, I had a phone call with a guy the day before. And yes, he said he wanted to come in the next morning. And yes, we talked about vitamins. And yes, we talked about a training program. But he never asked me about steroids in the phone call.
Huh.
And I told him I would sell him a bottle of vitamins for $20, not $100.
Yeah.
So I said to the prosecutor, okay, there are 2 things that were helpful to me. Number one is I want to hear the tape. Send me the tape so I can hear the recording.
Okay.
And number two is in this state, one of a few minority of states in the United States, you were allowed to depose the witnesses for the prosecution in advance of the trial. And so I said, okay, I want to talk to the snitch. I want to cross-examine your witness and your cop. So he goes, okay. So I listen to the tape, set up a date. I fly out to the state where it is. And she didn't have a lot of money. And, you know, some people think, oh, Rick Collins, you know, he charges enormous amounts. You know what? I try to help people no matter what. And you know, she was a modest, humble person, a good person. And I felt like I could help her. And so I wanted to help her. And I did. So I fly out there. I get there. The prosecutor says to me, I got bad news. I'm like, what's the bad news? Well, he's not available today. The snitch has a family emergency. He can't talk. You're going to have to come back next week or the week after. I'm like, I flew out here.
Yeah.
I flew from the East Coast. I'm not coming back again.
Yeah.
You know, that's absurd. You should have told me. He goes, well, you know, the only thing I can do is I can try to get him on the phone if you want to cross-examine him by phone. Now, I don't think any other lawyer in the history of the United States has ever done a cross-examination of a snitch on the phone.
Yeah.
Because you can't see him, you know, there's no body language, you know, I want to try to beat this guy up. I got to crush this guy.
Yeah.
So,
this is your one chance.
This is my one chance. So I said, well, if we come back in like 2 months, he goes, well, if you want to come back in 2 months, that's fine. But the way it works here is the window of her accepting the probation is up at the end of this month.
Okay.
So if either she takes the plea or you wait, but she's not getting a probation plea anymore. So basically it's a rock or a hard place. So I said, you know what? Get this guy on the phone.
Okay.
So I get him on the phone and I cross-examine him on the phone. And it's interesting because he tells me that, you know, the cop searches him, but the cop didn't search his underwear, didn't search his socks, didn't search his car, you know, all the places where in my mind it's possible that he might have hidden the vial and had it on him when he went into the you know, the gym.
Yeah.
And so I listened to the tape and I actually had my family listen to it to make sure that I was listening, that I was hearing it the right way. Because you hear all the conversation I've described before. And then you hear him say, okay, you know, you hear him like hand her money. And so I cross-examine her and I say, so you're telling, here's your story. So you're telling us that she gives you a bottle of vitamins and inside that bottle is a vial of steroids. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And you're saying you paid her $100 for that. Yes. Yes. I paid her $100 and she took that $100 and put it in her pocket. Well, I don't remember where she put it. Okay. Well, she didn't ring it up in the cash register. Well, no, because you're not ringing up a drug transaction in your cash register.
Sure.
Right. Right. Of course. That would be insane. Yes. Yes. Nobody would do that. Right. Yes. What he didn't realize was she had given me the receipt and I had a cash register receipt for $20 time coded.
Oh shit.
He was standing at the counter. Direct lie. Then I said, so after you get what you claim is a bottle of vitamins with a vial in it, you take that's the evidence. Yes. That's the strongest evidence. That's your case. Yes. Yes. So you take that vial, you take that bottle, you go directly to the cop, right? Oh, of course. You didn't go anywhere else, right? No, because that would taint the evidence, right? Well, wait. What? Well, I had to go to the bathroom. You went to the bathroom? Yeah, I had to go to the bathroom. I had to go to the bathroom really bad. You had to go to the bathroom so bad that you couldn't wait 5 minutes to give this evidence that you just told us, this drug transaction evidence, to your police officer? He goes, I had to go so bad, oh, so bad. I go, number one and number two. He goes, number one. So I said, well, you took the vial and the bottle and you left it there on the table? No. I took it into the, you took it into the bathroom. Yes. Where no one else could see it. Right. Yes. And you closed the door. Yes. And it was just you and that bottle in that bathroom. Yes. Yes. What he didn't realize was that the recorder continued until the time that he came back out. What you hear on the tape is him walking into the bathroom, closing the door, taking his keys. You hear the keys hit the porcelain of the counter. You hear him lift the lid of the toilet. You hear cellophane, the scrunching of cellophane. You hear, and it was so clear, the sound of tablets hitting the porcelain of the sink,
dude,
as he scoops out enough to hide, to make enough room to get that 10cc vial into the bottle of vitamins and close it back.
You hear it all. You hear it all.
You hear it all. What you don't hear is a single splash of number one. Nothing. Nada.
They didn't. The cop didn't know this. He
cop never listened.
Holy
cop never
shit!
Listened to the tape.
Wow.
Cop and DA never even listened to the tape.
Never needed to.
So
they
I confront
the vial.
Him with this. I confront him with this.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't like the way this is going.
Right. I bet not.
I understand that. You know, I fully understand because there's a name for this. He goes, there is. I go, yes. He goes, what is that? I said, it's called perjury.
Oh,
it's what you've
shit.
Just done. He goes, well, I want to talk to my lawyer.
Oh, my God.
And he hangs up the phone. The DA is as white as a sheet. And he says to me, would you take a misdemeanor?
Oh.
I said, here's how this is going to go. You're going to dismiss all of these charges. You're going to set her free.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the end of it. And I'm going to try to convince her not to sue you, the cop, and the entire DA's office for the travesty of justice that's just gone on here.
Holy
he goes,
shit.
Okay, I can live with that. And that was the end of it. And, you know, she was a great person. And it just, you know, as defense lawyers, I have to say, usually most of the people that we deal with are guilty of something. They may be overcharged or, you know, but usually it's rare that no crime actually was committed at all.
Hmm.
That the entire crime was a fabrication.
Wow. So he was just doing this just to get himself out of trouble, basically.
Well, I found out later that the deal he had was he had to set up three people in order to get a misdemeanor on his case.
Mm.
He had set up one. It was many months earlier. The cop was probably pressuring him saying, listen, if you're going to have to, it's going to be a felony unless you can find somebody else.
Yeah.
And this guy actually figured, well, you know, wow, you know, she's a bodybuilder. You know, she looks kind of jacked, you know, who's going to believe her if the case goes to trial?
Sure.
You know, it was like low hanging fruit for him.
Yeah.
But what a total piece of garbage.
No kidding.
To, you know, to set up somebody, to set up a woman who didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
To get yourself out of your own bind. I mean, a total piece of crap guy. But those are the sorts of cases where, you know, and Derek was like, oh my God, you know, Derek was like, you know, but those are the kind of cases that make me love what I do so much.
God, yeah.
And to be able to be there, to set things right, to do the right thing by somebody, you know, because her life would have derailed, even with probation, you know, with a felony conviction.
Yeah.
It would have followed her everywhere.
Yeah.
She didn't deserve that. She didn't deserve what that guy did to her. And so, you know, I'm just blessed that I have the skill set and the background and the knowledge to be able to be here for people who need me. And I'm going to be here for a long, long time. I love what I do. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk. You know, a lot of my clients later become my Facebook friends or my Instagram followers and stuff. And which, you know, also makes me very, very happy because they're good people. And, you know, I'm on Instagram, Rick Collins ESQ. It's sort of this mix of bodybuilding and law kind of thing. You know, I love being a lawyer and I also love being a bodybuilder. And, you know, we've talked about before, maybe we could talk sometime again about the lessons we learn as bodybuilders that make us better at whatever it is that we do.
Absolutely.
Because I think I'm a better lawyer than I ever would have been for having had the discipline and the perseverance, the overcoming obstacles that bodybuilding teaches you. But I love what I do. And I'm grateful that you gave me the opportunity to spend a little time with you.
Hey, you're going to be speaking down at the Arnold too, aren't you?
So, yeah. So I'm 2 weeks away from the Arnold. I'm doing a round table with a few other very distinguished guests. I did it last year. So that's exciting. We're going to talk about PEDs in sports. We're going to even do CBD, cannabidiol, yeah. and the, some of the cannabis issues. And I'm also a board member now. This is my first year as the on the global advisory board of the International Sports Hall of Fame.
No kidding.
Which Bob Goldman does every year. And so we've got some great inductees with Saturday morning of the Arnold. And I'm also a sponsor of the Arnold Amateur Show.
Oh, cool.
So I'll be up on the stage, on the main stage in the expo Saturday morning, giving out trophies. I've gotten to give trophies to people I know on stage, competitive athletes, which is just like fantastic. So I love what I do, Scott. I'm the happiest kid on the block.
Hell yeah. Well, guys, check out the show notes. We'll have information about checking out Rick at the Arnold. We've got his website. We've got his Instagram. Rick Collins, thank you so much for your time, brother. This has been freaking awesome, man.
Love it, brother. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.